and a lot of it was very good. It didn't take 4 stars to get the old guards back up. Chef Alfred Portali, a native of Buffalo, New York, remembers the night in 1985 that Gotham Bar and Grill, where he was the chef, earned 3 stars from the New York Times. When the review broke, I went to Bud's and met some friends, and I remember there was somebody from the Four Seasons there. They were perturbed. How can they let this punk... They said something. It was like, how can a restaurant that does this get 3 stars? Phil Carlson, Chef Leslie Revson's widower, tells a similar story. One night, he and Revson were dining at one of the top French restaurants in town, visiting with the chef at the end of the meal. Discussing the influx of Americans into the profession, the chef sneered, "I know. Anybody can be a chef now. Even cab drivers are doing it." Which Carlson took as a not-too-veiled reference to a rising American chef who was known to have driven a taxi at one point. When you're breaking away from either traditional French restaurants like Lutèce or Le Côte Basque or what was going on at Le Cirque, there definitely was suspicion, in some cases antipathy, especially if the new kids on the block got a lot of love from a critic, says Josh Wesson. And somehow it was perceived to be coming at the expense of the old guard. No doubt about that. But I don't think the reverse was true. Whether it was the Waltucks or the Wines or Len and Karen Allison or David and Susan Lederman, there was an abiding respect and love for where food had come from, an almost insane amount of respect for what the generation of chefs and restaurateurs had accomplished. It wasn't that people were breaking away for the sake of innovation or to be different. They were expanding on the culinary traditions and expertise of old-school restaurants, and then combining that with new ingredients, access to new foods, techniques that had been developed both in France and in Japan and places like that, and creating something that didn't exist before. So there was a lot of respect for what was, but it didn't flow in the other direction from many of the great storied restaurants of the 60s and 70s, handing off the baton to the next generation of really exciting, innovative chefs. The resistance to Americans taking a claim as chefs in their own right was nothing new. Larry Forgione had detected the same hostility years earlier at Regine's. "I wanted to be very respectful to chefs that I felt were important," says Forgione. "I certainly didn't think of myself as important. So I went to Le Caravelle and the 5 or 6 great restaurants of New York. Andre Saltner was just an incredible human being, friendly and supportive of, at the time, maybe it wasn't of American cuisine, but of a new young chef. Jean-Jacques Rochot at Le Côte Basque was the same way. Then there were other ones, like La Grenouille, where they were basically like, 'You're paying homage, now it's time for you to go.' I was just coming over to say hello. I was coming over to pay homage, but didn't expect to be shown the door after I did it. You didn't have 5 minutes to talk to me?" The same tension created a problem for cooking school grads looking to round out their education. He came out of the CIA and came to New York in the early 80s, and there were 8 or 9 restaurants to work in, says Colomico. That was it. But most of the great French kitchens in New York City wouldn't hire Americans. "I wanted to work at Lutèce," says Kinch. "I met with Andre Saltner for about 10 minutes. He kind of laughed me off." Kinch eventually found a foothold in New York City, at the bistro La Petite Ferme, where David Waltuck had cooked in the 1970s. Being declined by Saltner was essentially a rite of passage in New York City. Most describe his rejection in kinder terms than Kinch, but they all believe he turned them down because they were Americans. Peter Hoffman says he would have washed dishes at Lutèce. Revson's widower Carlson says she would have worked for him even after having been a chef in her own right, but he simply told her, "Leslie, I just can't." For his part, Saltner insists that he had a small kitchen and a loyal crew, and so rarely had open positions. And he's quick to point out that he did hire a few Americans, such as Bill Peet and Henry Meir. And getting hired overseas was, generally speaking, even more difficult. Daniel Boulud, who came to the United States in 1981, insists that anti-Americanism wasn't to blame for the resistance to employing Americans in French kitchens in New York, but rather that Americans simply lacked the training required to thrive in a French kitchen. "There was a limitation of opportunity for an American to really learn to become a great chef," says Boulud. What set him apart is he hired Americans. Against this backdrop, A network of U.S.-based French and European figures coalesced to connect American prospects with the experience they craved, a sort of culinary underground railroad. The three main operatives were CIA instructors like Eugene Bernard and Léon Denain, who had direct ties to French culinary royalty, such as Paul Bocuse and Fernand Poin, meat purveyor Marc Sarrazin of De Braga and Spittler, and chef Jean-Jacques Rochot, who was the chef owner of Le Lavandou, and purchased La Côte Basque from Henri Soulé in 1979, and was the first high-profile French chef willing to enlist a predominantly American crew. Jean-Jacques Rochot understood very early on, not that the French were dying, but if you wanted to get on the right bus, you needed to get all these young American guys working in your kitchen, because those were the people that were going to move up, says Charlie Palmer. In many cases, the Americans were so desperate for opportunity that they took a passive role in their own fate, allowing the elders to pull their strings. Today, Palmer lords over an empire of restaurants and hotels from his home base in Northern California. But in 1979, as a student at the CIA, he was a spectator in his own budding career. One winter day that year, Denain and the young buck headed down to New York City and had lunch at Le Lavandou, a petite bistro on East 61st Street near Lexington Avenue. At the end of the meal, Denain and Rochot spoke in French for about 10 minutes, then Rochot turned to Palmer and said in his trademark mumbled French accent, "Okay, you start to March 26. "There was no discussion of what you're going to do," remembers Palmer. "What you're going to get paid, if you're going to get paid." And Denain said, "Don't worry, my boy. Everything is set." It was a deal. So that's what I did. I showed up, and that was it. Rochot, in need of more cooks, sometimes asked the Americans to recruit their friends, leading Palmer to reach out to his CIA classmate, Philadelphia native Frank Crispo. Another hopeful, dispatched by the CIA's Bernard, was Rick Moonen, a restless, raspy-voiced cook from Flushing, Queens, also sent to Rochot in 1979, as Rochot was preparing to open La Côte Basque. Enshrouded in a black cashmere overcoat borrowed from his father, Moonen showed up for an interview at La Côte Basque, then a construction site. He asked a Frenchman in red flannel outside the storefront if he could point him to Chef Rahou, mangling the name. The man grumbled, led Moonen inside. "He opens the door. I follow him. He closes the door, locks it behind him. We entered through the men's room. Now, I didn't know that's where Henri Soulé had passed away, but that's how I first step into La Côte Basque, through the men's room side door." Turns out the Frenchman was Rochot himself, punking the young American. "He brought me downstairs into the kitchen. I'm following him around for 20 minutes. He doesn't say a word to me. He stops. He gives somebody some money. Talks to another guy. Gives some instruction over here. Down the stairs. Round the corner. Jackhammers. He turns to me. He goes, 'So you want a job?' I said, 'Yeah.' He says, 'Okay.' That was the interview. He said, 'Come in on Monday.' He didn't tell me a time. Nothing. I'm getting dust all over my dad's overcoat. I'm stressing out over how I'm going to get through this interview. But Eugene Bernard had made the phone call, and I was already hired. He just wanted to see me and tell me I had to come in on Monday." Palmer, Moonen, and Crispo weren't the first Yanks Rochot hired. A few had previously worked for him at Le Lavandou. Assigning young American cooks hither and yon wasn't the only way in which their European puppet masters demonstrated their benevolent power. A young cook named David Boulay, who had worked for, among others, Roger Verger in France, joined the staff at La Côte Basque shortly after it opened under Rochot. Remembers that Rochot used to give me my mail from Verger opened all the time. A few years later, Boulay was working under Sayoc at Le Cirque. Because of Sayoc's and Le Cirque owner Cirio Maccioni's ties to France, the restaurant was a frequent stop for the likes of Bocuse when they were in New York. "I went out in the dining room and I remember Paul Bocuse, Verger, Craig Claiborne, Pierre Franey. They're all sitting there," says Boulay. "And Cirio sat me down at the end of the table, and they told me, like they always did, 'This is what you're doing next, going back to Verger and opening in San Francisco. There's no discussion. This is what you're going to do. This is going to be the best thing for you, and you're going to have a good time. You're going to like it. When we first opened up, we were making these chicken breasts that were hollowed out and stuffed with a chicken mousse and truffles, remembers Moonin. It was a very big deal. It was poached and sliced and circled with a morel sauce. These are my formative years, so these things are ingrained deeply in my taste memory. The smell of the restaurant, the sounds of it, the feel of it. Every living thing about it I remember as if it was yesterday. In keeping with a trend of the day, the food was served on the Villeroy and Bach basket weave plate, also admired and used by Barry Wine at the Quilted Giraffe and Jean Bertrenu at L'Hermitage in Los Angeles. Rochot, who was perennially hunched over, could come off as gruff and introverted. But he had a sense of humor, says Moonin. And he loved my sense of humor and Charlie Palmer's sense of humor. He had a love of what he did. He was an amazing artist, but he was very quiet. According to Moonin, Rochot had moved on from the minutiae of kitchen work and was more concerned with building his empire, carving meats on gyridons in the dining room, especially in the VIP section. He wasn't an instructor. He wasn't a mentor where he would take you and show you. He would say, "I'll show you tomorrow." And he never showed you tomorrow. He trusted that you were going to do it on your own. And we did figure it out. Echoes Palmer, "We could relate to him, but he honestly didn't teach us much. We were taught by some of the senior sous chefs in the beginning. And Rochot was, I don't want to say, a figurehead. He was always at the restaurant, but he wasn't really in the kitchen cooking with us besides tasting something and saying, 'Hey, stupid, it's...'" So Americans had to do their homework to fill in the gaps left by cooking school. "I had to make a cassoulet. I didn't know what a cassoulet was," says Moonin. "Fuck, man. I didn't learn that at school. I'm not French. But I'm the saucier, so I'm in charge of making the cassoulet. Cassoulet is many different layers." He said, "You make a lamb shoe, you take a confit, you make the sauces, and..." He's saying all these things. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. "You make a lamb shoe?" Moonin would furiously scribble down whatever flowed from Rochot's mouth, then scurry home and hit the books. "I'm looking up shoe in cookbooks. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have Google." He finally realized that the chef meant lamb stew. "The French can't say S-T," says Moonin. There was also the matter of Rochot's patois, French-accented and marble-mouthed. "He mumbled like crazy," says Moonin. "I learned how to answer people by inflection." If Rochot's unintelligible statement went up at the end, that was a question. You had to take a chance. "Oui, chef," was mostly the correct answer. If, on the other hand, Rochot furrowed his brow, Moonin guessed that the right reply was, "No, no, no, chef. No, no. Absolutely no." For a quick reference in La Côte Basque and other kitchens, another book became indispensable. Louis Saulnier's Le Répertoire de la Cuisine, a pocket guide to 6,000 preparations. Though published in hardcover, the skinny trim size made it possible for cooks to keep it in their back pockets. Why was Rochot so open to hiring the other? Colomico offers this perspective. "Rochot was an orphan. He was adopted. His life was very abusive. Whoever his adoptive parents were treated him like chattel. He slept in the barn. He took care of the animals. He had no rights. He wasn't their kid. So at the age of 12 or 13, he got a job in a restaurant where he actually got to sleep indoors in a bunk with a bunch of other kids. He got to eat. It was paradise. And he couldn't read. He's illiterate. So he comes here to the States, married, had been working in the Caribbean in funky places, and he can't read. So his wife has to read the leases to him, has to read the agreements to him. So he gets what it's like to be the underdog. His whole fucking life he's been the underdog. What set him apart is he hired Americans," says Moonin. "He was chastised for it. How did I hear that? I don't know if it was discussions I had with him or if it was confirmed with other people that were involved with the Vatel Club. It was exclusively run by the French Mafia in the beginning, and he was chastised by his peers because he supported Americans. They were wondering why he wasn't being more nationalistic and hiring only the French." Moonin is quick to point out that the front of the house at La Côte Basque was entirely French, specifically from Brittany, or at least French-speaking. He got tomatoes thrown at him in Vittel meetings. I don't know literally, but figuratively for sure. He got beat up. He believed that Americans were hard-working and were hungry. Rochelle one time admitted that he liked working with American cooks better than French, says Crispo, because they were easier to deal with. And he got huge criticism from all his Frenchy chef friends, because he was telling the truth. I don't know if this is a fact. I don't know if you can even check it. But for a time, they threw him out of the Vittel Club, says Colomico. It was the idea that he had crossed this line, and that was considered indefensible. And Rochelle said to me, you know, I looked at these young American cooks and I watched them work and I thought, they're as good as the French guys. Equals, maybe better. Why don't I give them a chance? He was the guy that broke the ice. Before Rochelle, you couldn't have gotten a job in those kitchens. As the 1980s unspooled, more kitchen opportunities presented themselves to Americans in New York City. But Rochelle's pro-American attitude was a rarity. In most brigades, there was an anti-American sentiment. Americans and French worked together, but the relationship ended at the stoves. We didn't hang out with the French guys that much, says Palmer. Xavier LaRue was with us, and he was a really nice guy, and taught us a lot, and was really a good partner with us in the kitchen. But we never hung out with Xavier outside of the kitchen. Bill Yossis, a pastry chef who came up around this time, charitably suggests that part of the reason might have been that many Frenchmen were self-conscious about their English. Crispo, who moved from Le Cote Basque to the Polo to work with Daniel Boulou, remembers one particular cook Boulou brought in from France. He hated Americans. We sucked. He came off the plane. Everybody sucks. But he didn't speak much English. So it was great getting back at him because he would ask me how to say something and I would tell him completely the opposite. And he would goof up. And somebody would say, hey, how you doing? And he would say, hey, you suck. Then he turned around. He changed. He saw that we were working. Did he ever apologize? No. He's French. The young Americans were gleaning the knowledge they craved, but at the same time, their eyes were open to the realities of restaurant life, a far cry from the idealized world portrayed in Great Chefs of France, even in French kitchens. It was incredibly busy, says Moonen of his days at Le Cote Basque. When it first opened up, it was so hot, it was so underventilated, that the plastic coating on the outer part of the fluorescent lights melted and fell to the ground. I was swimming in my sweat in my own boots. We used to wring our trousers out, never mind our pants, our jackets, from sweat, recalls Boulay. Details like that, however, were nothing compared to the state of affairs at Le Cirque, one of the most celebrated restaurants of the day. But behind the scenes, the high volume and power clientele, regulars included everybody from Woody Allen to Henry Kissinger, produced a constant pressure that led to flaring tempers and some breathtaking shortcuts. Arnold Rossman, who began cooking at Le Cirque in 1981, recalls that Sayoc and his sous chefs would often shout, "Dead or alive," as code to indicate a dish had to be delivered to the pass ASAP. It didn't matter what shape that food was in. You got it on a plate and you handed it to him, says Rossman. I remember the first day I cut a rack of lamb and they wanted it, let's say, medium. It was bloody rare, but I put it on the plate and I handed it to the chef. The stressful environment also led to frequent turnover. Remembers Rossman, the first day my memory is just a blur of screaming, total pandemonium and chaos. The kitchen's not that big. It was never designed for the kind of volume we were doing. So the night crew was not allowed to set foot in the kitchen until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That would give enough time for the day guys to get ready, get up and go, and be doing lunch service because there was the backup crew doing preparation for lunch anyway, once lunch was going. And at 2 o'clock we were allowed in the kitchen. We walk into the kitchen at 2 o'clock, and Philippe, the entremetis slash sous chef, he's French. He and the chef are 2 inches away from each other, screaming at each other in French. I mean, the veins in their necks are bulging. They're literally spitting into each other's... I don't understand French at this point, and I don't know what they're saying, but they are furious. Back and forth, back and forth. And at one point, that's it. It's over. Philippe turns around, he grabs his knives, and he makes a very rude gesture to the chef and storms out. And the chef is heaving, and he starts looking around the kitchen, and our heads are down, and all of a sudden I hear, Rossman, The newbie approached the chef. Rossman, you are the new entremetis.
Oui, chef.
I'm just standing there, and he goes, what are you doing? And I'm like, what do you want me to do? You are the new entremetis. Get to work. Chef, I just started yesterday. I have no idea what to do.
Sayoc directed Rossman to Ralph Tingle, the sauté cook alongside whom he had worked on his first day.
Go talk to Ralph. He will explain to you what to do.
Rossman found Tingle in the back, head down, chopping on his cutting board. He explained the situation and his battlefield promotion.
Congratulations, said Tingle. What do you need from me?
The chef told me to come to you to explain to me what to do.
Tingle went blank, expressionless.
What's the matter? Asked Rossman.
I just started the day before yesterday.
Terence Brennan, obsessed with getting into a French kitchen, sent letters to 8 New York City restaurants. Only one responded. Lutesse's Soltner succinctly informed Brennan that there was no room in his brigade.
I had to look up brigade, laughs Brennan.
But Soltner invited the young cook to visit him next time he was in New York City. Brennan visited, knocked on the kitchen door, and the great man spent close to half an hour with him, then referred him to Sayoc at Le Cirque. Brennan was through the looking glass.
I went in there and I saw all the pettifours. I've never seen this stuff before. I'm thinking, oh my God, and I'm just so naive about everything.
After a brief interview in Sailhack's famously cramped office, Brennan had to sit in the doorway. He returned to Virginia, then was summoned back within days when an opening presented itself. Brennan didn't even ask how much the job paid. He turned around and came right back. Brennan replaced none other than Rossman. I got one day of training from Pierre, the sous chef. One day, and they were talking in French. I didn't know any French. The assistant saucier was really the légumier, or the vegetable person, doing all the garnishing for all the plates. And I got my ass kicked. Dover's soul, I don't even know. I didn't know anything. It was an intense kitchen. This is back when Sailhack was in the kitchen, just to put it in context. And nothing taken away from Daniel Boulou, who succeeded Sailhack, because he made it great. But there were only 18 people in the kitchen when Sailhack ran it. One sous chef and 18 in the kitchen. When Daniel took over, he had 3 sous chefs and 36 people in the kitchen. So every single night we're in the shit. We're in the weeds. Every night. Monday, Tuesday, doesn't matter. 6 days a week, every night, he's cussing and screaming. And I'm like, holy shit! What did I get into? And I wasn't physically in shape. Every plate I had to bend over in the oven, take it out, every single plate, making the garnish and running around. Back then you were non-stop. You were running and you didn't sit down. You just barely made it for service. I'm not exaggerating. And every single night, be it Monday or a Saturday, over 200 dinners, 3 people on the line. 3 people! Saucier, me in the middle, and the grill guy. That's it. Brennan also recalls that during particularly busy services, the sous chef would come around from doing a little prep for the parties for the next day and throw poussin in the fry-later, throw racks of lamb in the fry-later. Inclined to think only the best of the French, Brennan figured the frying must have been a secret searing technique practiced in France. But it was just because we were in the shit and he wanted to get it going fast, just to get it out. That I found out later, says Brennan today. That same year, disenchantment with Le Cirque, ironically, led to an early alliance between a French-born chef and an American-born contemporary, both of whom would go on to become industry legends.
I generally loved Sirio, but I hated the work environment, remembers Boulet, who started at Le Cirque in 1981. I remember talking to my girlfriend at that time about how I'm going to go back to school. I can't do this. At Le Cirque, there were 3 of us. Philippe, who was the sous chef, and Elaine Sayoc was a lot of time in the office. We did 277 covers one night. The menu was an encyclopedia. And if someone sat down and said, can I have sole Véronique? It's not on the menu. You got the Dover sole, and you got a can of grapes, and you had to make sole Véronique. It was ridiculous. You just could never keep up with the amount of volume. Nothing was cooked to order. You had a big bain-marie with ladles. And a lot of things were cooked in advance sitting up there.
And when they called for it, you threw it on a plate, or you threw it on a copper thing, and you threw a sauce with it, and it went out in the dining room with some vegetables or whatever. It was so hard that you never felt you did anything right.
Boulet developed the opinion that the much-lauded French chefs in New York City were closed off from modern times. The food at Le Cirque, he laments, wasn't 100% plated food yet, a reference to his own Nouvelle experiences in France. In time, he'd come to believe that the chefs he was working for in the United States hadn't eaten the evolved food of modern France, let alone worked in one of those kitchens. They had learned how to French cook in New York from a group of French people that was very focused, very tight from almost the World's Fair. A lot of the restaurants had the same style. Le Cote Basque was a little different, but if you went to Pavillon, Le Grenou, Le Cygne, Le Cirque, Le Périgord, they were pretty much all the same kinds of menus. The contrast between what he'd cooked in France and what he wanted for himself in America and what was available was crushing. The bodies and the amount of people in the kitchen were not at all conducive to me and my group, which were students of the Nouvelle Cuisine, so we all felt lost. One afternoon that year, Boulet prepared a lunch for his friend, the pastry chef Jean-Pierre Lemesson, and two friends of his. I made a pot-au-feu, and I had great cheese, and Jean-Pierre made all this food. The day before, he said, I forgot I've got a friend coming in from France. Can I bring him? I said, yeah, sure. Go ahead. I have plenty of food. So he brought him in. That was Daniel Boulou. He came from JFK to my apartment, and we all were talking about how much there is to do here. And Daniel says that was the day that he decided to make his career in New York. There was a gap of 40 years, and how are we going to transfer this style of eating into what we were taught? Nouvelle cuisine. Healthier, cleaner, more detailed, plated food. A whole different structure of cuisine. What was the opportunity? So the possibilities were to team up and try to transfer the cuisine into a different direction. We had a pact. Asked about this, Boulou, a consummate industry politician, squirms and jokes. I have no idea what he's talking about. Boulou had come to New York to take over the kitchen at the Polo restaurant at the Westbury Hotel. But 5 years later, in 1986, he replaced Sayoc as chef of Le Cirque. He was the godfather to the chefs. An advocate for young Americans during these years was Mark Sarrazin, a butcher from France's Cherrel region, who came to the United States in 1954, became a salesman for meat wholesaler De Braga and Spittler, and bought the company in 1973. De Braga and Spittler supplied many of the best restaurants in Manhattan. Sarrazin isn't remembered for his product, but for his vast network and willingness to help cooks and chefs at every level, an unofficial one-man employment agency for the entire industry. He was the godfather to the chefs, says Boulou. He was the agency to the cooks. When we were kids, if you were at Jean-Jacques Rousseau's for a couple of years and you wanted to move, you'd say, Chef, I don't want to offend you, but I've been with you for 3 years. I've learned a lot. I want a new job. He'd probably send you to Sarrazin, says Colomico. That's what happened to me. You'd go to his office, go downtown, walk through that little parking lot, up that long step, and in there would be Mark. He was the guy. All the French restaurants bought meat from him. Sarrazin's office was unassuming, wood-paneled affair, lined with photographs of chefs. A meeting there was a real get for an aspiring cook, and a sit-down lunch with Sarrazin at one of his favorite restaurants meant you had arrived, like a comic's first shot on Johnny Carson. Being French and being connected with all the French chefs in town, he was the one who helped all those kids from the CIA to enter into La Côte Basque, into La Caravelle, into Le Cirque, into even, not Le Pavillon because that's too old, but into all those restaurants, remembers Boulou. As soon as somebody would lose a job, he would help him find another job. He was distributing meat in the clubs. He was distributing meat in the restaurants. He was distributing meat in the hotels. He was distributing meat in the major, larger caterers. Basically, he was covering the entire spectrum of the industry, and in a very wide range also, not only New York, but the five boroughs. He was very French, and very appreciative of everyone. It didn't matter. And his son was born in America, so he had this mentality of an American as well, when it came to embracing young talent. He was the nicest guy, says Colomico.
It was a different time. If you didn't buy your meat from him, would it have affected your business? Maybe. There was a kind of a criticism that he had a lock on things. I guess he did. It was business. But beyond that, his personal generosity was amazing. Because we were the first generation of American chefs, trying to climb a ladder that was in French, or in German, or in Swiss, but mostly in French. And you had to get past the gatekeepers, and you had to work within the system. And he was the guy. Sarrazin was also known for his indirect interviewing style.
You can learn an awful lot about somebody by the way he dresses, how he or she behaves, Sarrazin said at the time. What is the handshake like? Does the person light a cigarette without asking?
It was in these telling details that he formed his opinion of talent and character, and helped make matches between cooks and chefs, chefs and owners. By all accounts, he spent as much time administering to the affairs of his business as he did doling out advice and counsel. A typical morning found him working the phones, fielding calls from all over the city, and occasionally the country, followed by lunch in one of Manhattan's grand French restaurants. Then came drop-ins on kitchens around the metropolis, where he did business and kept tabs on job openings and other possibilities. And the day was capped with dinner at the likes of Le Cirque and La Côte Basque.
We all lived like rats.
For newcomers to the city, it was a bizarre double life, cooking refined French food by day, then returning to a squalid residence when the kitchen closed. Line cooks make a paltry living, and the crime-addled New York City of the late 1970s and early 80s brought that reality into high relief.
I was petrified, recalls Palmer, who took a $78 per month sublet on West 43rd Street in Hell's Kitchen. I'd come home from La Côte Basque and there would be hookers sitting on the building stoop. They all knew my name. They were like, hey, white boy's home. But I adjusted quickly. I became pretty comfortable very quick.
Brennan would leave Le Cirque, return to a place he was renting on Long Island.
I was physically exhausted, the screaming and yelling. I'm beat up, and I'm sleeping on a couch with punk rockers. I would stay up until 4 or 5 in the morning partying. I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? Then I got an apartment in Queens. I just signed something real quick. It was a dungeon, one of those illegal dungeon apartments. There was no sunlight. I'd come out at 9, 10 in the morning and be like Dracula. The sun!
It was exciting, says John Schenck, a cook from Buffalo, New York.
The first day I moved here, I had to go into Williamsburg, to the Hasidic community, to buy futons. And I didn't even know what a Hasid was. I came back with the futons. I'm like, you won't believe what I just saw. Didn't even have the idea that that existed. I remember driving up First Street, where it veers off of Houston, goes on that angle. And it was an uber ghetto. Everyone was all over the place. There were fires in the garbage cans. We used to live in Brooklyn, so we'd go over the Brooklyn Bridge, and there would be all the hookers standing there by Sammy's Romanian on that block. I remember one having this huge razor blade inside her glove. She took off her mitten. I was sitting in the cab. You see this huge razor blade? It was a different world. It was gritty. I liked it a lot.
We all lived like rats, you know?
Says Tracy Desjardins. I lived in a living room and slept on a futon.
New York was so dangerous. I lived on the Upper East Side on 82nd, between 2nd and 3rd, so I would catch the subway. I almost got my brains creamed in. I was walking to the subway and there was just a bunch of young kids. And I was by myself. It was just one of those moments where you say a little prayer and hope that they don't turn their attention to you. They had baseball bats and shit. They were looking for trouble. And it was just obvious. You're just walking along and you see that and you can't turn around. You keep going and you just hope that they're not going to, you know. So I called my mom. My parents had not been real supportive of what I was up to. I was self-funded and didn't have any help. And I said, you've got to give me $100 a week to take a cab home at night. I'm going to get killed. Everyone I knew got mugged. It was dangerous. I never did. But I felt that threat all the time. So my mom started sending me $100 a week to take a cab home at night.
Danny Meyer, who was beginning to envision what would become his first restaurant, Union Square Cafe, in the early 1980s, recalls of the restaurant's neighborhood.
It was really dicey.
I remember very well at least three occasions walking to Union Square Cafe on a Saturday morning, and there would be a chalk outline on the sidewalk of someone who had presumably been shot the night before. The city could be grittily seductive to French newcomers as well. Boulou remembers New York as mad, not very safe, not very clean. I was a little bit lost because I was not a New Yorker then. He recalls one night in particular after a private party at the Westbury. There was this guy who organized the party who said, "I'm going to show you the town. Let me take you downtown." So we went to the meatpacking district. There was the Hellfire Club there. It was a basement where they were all hanging on ropes and fucking each other. I mean, they were like cabins where you could watch people getting sucked over or fucked over. It was stables and you peep over. For us, it was all about being a voyeur and curiosity. Every time we had a friend coming from Europe, we said, "Okay, we've got to take you to a place." It was so fucked up downtown. You had to go to France. That was it. The ultimate immersive experience for a young American at the time was to take the plunge and commit to a stage in France. What became a de rigueur rite of passage for future generations was a novelty at the time, and one that wasn't easily accessed. The very concept of staging was unique, hearkening back to another era, suggesting a quest for knowledge. An unpaid position, undertaken in exchange for the conference of experience and skill. Says Thomas Keller, "From 1978 until 1983, it was that quest of trying to get somebody to commit to hiring me. And during that period of time, I amassed an enormous amount of information about France. Articles on Gregory Usher, who ultimately started the Ritz-Carlton cooking program. Robert Noah, who was an influential American over there who would do culinary tours. I wrote Julia Child. She introduced me to La Varenne founder Anne Willen." Keller's big break came when Jean Gouta of the Westbury Hotel, where Keller was sous-chef to Daniel Boulou, set him up with a job at a one-star restaurant at the Hôtel du Vie in Arbois. "I was to stay there for 3 months, I think. I got there and I stayed there for 3 days. I was miserable. The Hôtel du Vie was this restaurant in the basement where my job was to get the coal and fire the ovens at 5 in the morning. My window was black, and I didn't understand it was black until I went down the next morning, realized that the chimney was next to my window. Light bulbs hanging from wires from the ceiling. It was like prehistoric, dark ages. I don't know how many Americans they saw over there. It was kind of a one-horse town. Reminded me of something from a Western movie. I was only there for 3 days. I was terrified because I was in this environment that had nothing. The image of that environment or the reality of that environment was nowhere in my catalog of images. I'm reading about Noah. I'm reading about Anne Willen. I'm reading about Télévan. I'm reading about all the great restaurants, all the great chefs. And I've just come from the Polo. I was like, this is insane. How could this be? I'm in France." Keller called his friend, restaurateur Sergei Raoul, owner of an eponymous bistro in Soho, and a Frenchman. His advice? "Go to Paris. Hang out there and see what you can do." "So I actually did what everybody told me to do 5 years earlier," says Keller. "Just go. Go knock on kitchen doors." But I was much better prepared. I was a much better cook. I had much more knowledge. I had much more information. I made some great contacts. And within a couple weeks I was done, for the 9, 10 months, or 12 months I was there with my stages. I had them all lined up, then floated and got invited back to Télévan. Everything was just beautiful. "You had to go to France," says Colicchio. "That was it. For me, it wasn't about going there and learning dishes. For me, it was going there to understand why, not how. Like, why certain things just made sense. I ended up going to Gascony." Kinch felt a similar pull. The thing was to get out of New Orleans, a town of 5,000 restaurants and 5 recipes, and get to New York, because New York was like the American epicenter, and work there, says Kinch. And the whole point of moving to New York was to find a place that would be a stepping stone to get to France. At that time, I was hearing rumblings about Chez Panisse and the things that were going on in California, but it really didn't resonate with me at that time. California was another world apart. It's just work in France, work in France. Stay in France for as long as possible.
Learn as much as I can about being a French chef so someday I can apply it and be an American chef. That was everything. That was the mantra.
Americans' reception in France was a mixed bag. Some were welcomed as equals in the kitchen. Others were treated as curiosities or with hostility.
I was sort of this novelty to the French chefs in the restaurant, says Eric Bromberg, who stodged at Le Recamy in Paris while attending culinary school at Le Cordon Bleu.
They used to call me George Bush or Ronald Reagan, which is pretty funny. Anyone from America they called Reagan. Ketchup and Coke were the two big insults. They called Coke vin américain, American wine. And at every staff meal, they'd put a bottle of ketchup next to me.
Desjardins, encouraged to work in France by mentor Splitchell, landed a position working with the Tuagros family in Rouen. There, Desjardins says she was received as a freak.
I was American. I was a woman. I was 19. I was so young and so naive. If I knew then what I know now, I would have never attempted that. It was insane. I'd never been out of California. I just plunked myself down in the middle of nowhere in France. But I had such drive. So I went to Tuagros. Arrived there, met the family. Michel, Pierre Tuagros' son, who had spent time at Chez Panisse, was running the kitchen. It was sort of the beginning of his tenure there. Jean died, I think, the year I started cooking, so in 83. So this was 86, so Jean hadn't been gone for too long. Michel was entering the kitchen with Pierre. Michel was showing me around and walked in the locker room, and he's like, "You can't change here. You have to come to work in your whites because there's only the boys' locker room." They didn't know what to do with me. It was tough. I came from being Chef Boissonnier, fish chef, for Joachim, to being an apprentice. So I was knocked way down the rung. I was back to cleaning lettuce and chopping herbs. So it was hard. I understood that that was where my place was in the kitchen, but I was capable of so much more. And there was no way to show that. That wasn't a possibility. You didn't do that kind of thing in those kitchens. It wasn't the way things worked. So I humbly kept my place in the corner. It was pretty lonely. It was so much more controlled than what we were doing in the States at that point in time. In Michelin three-star restaurants, the same thing happened every day. It was 95 covers for lunch, 95 covers for dinner. And you got to work at 8, and you left the kitchen at 3. You came back at 5, and you worked until 12. And you went out to the discos at night, and danced for a few hours, then went to the café and the boulangerie, and had a fresh croissant before you went to bed. And you slept for 3 hours, and you got up and did the same thing again, and slept in the afternoon. You had one day off every week. And it was so interesting talking to the people that you worked with because these were all French boys who were between 17 and 23. They were young. A lot of them came from royal culinary families. Their fathers had been Michelin 2- or 3-star restaurant chefs, and they were at Tuagros working for their father's friend. It wasn't full of possibility. It was a different world because it was almost like a caste system. These guys were doing this because their fathers and their grandfathers and their grandfathers before them had done it. It didn't have the same feeling of what we were doing in California, which was the world of possibilities. None of these guys had ever eaten any ethnic food. I mean, Italian food was ethnic to them.
This is going to change. It's just a matter of when and how. Whether they achieved it at home, abroad, or both, a funny thing happened to many of those Americans who mastered French cuisine. They quickly developed a desire to move beyond it, to forge their own style, whether a personalized answer to nouvelle cuisine or, in many cases, the development of a distinctly American repertoire founded on the hard-earned techniques they picked up from the French. As it turned out, what both French and American alike perceived as a weakness, the United States' lack of a gastronomic tradition, turned out to be a strength. Without eons of history to constrain them, they quickly grew tired of the norm and eager to imprint their plates with a personality all their own, drawing from regional, cultural, and even familial influences. For Forgione, one of the first to show the way toward an American style, an early revelation came after making that goodwill tour of New York's great French restaurants. He gathered menus from all of them, even those who dissed him, laid them out next to each other. Say each menu had 20 things on it,
so if you had 6 menus, you had the possibility of 120 things. But there were only about 30 things that were on these 6 menus. Just as many of the restaurants featured murals painted by Jean Page. Everybody had Riz de Veau Chanterelles. Everybody had tournedos, probably not Rossini, but a tournedos dish that they all had. They were very similar menus at the 6 great restaurants. It was amazing to me that that was going on. In contrast, the sameness of French menus didn't bother younger cooks like Colomico at the time. It was such a different world back then. If you could take a snapshot of the menus at Le Côte Basque, Le Caravelle, Le Tesse, Le Cygne, in any given month of any given year, they're identical. Literally, you could be the saucier at one restaurant one day and move over to another restaurant because we were cooking from Escoffier. You simply had to know the garnishes and how to make them, but that was still magic for us, because we didn't know that. Some, like the 5 couples, leapfrogged classic training. Others participated in it. Once that education was completed, though, perhaps owing to something inherent in the American character, or to that generation, or a combination of the two, it was almost inevitable that even the most classically trained cooks began to forge a style all their own. "It became obvious to me I was never going to be French, nor did I want to be French," says Palmer. While working for a show, he read about goings-on in American kitchens, foremost among them Forgione's at the River Café. "I'm not going to change my name, you know? And I thought, too, classical French cooking, all this cream and butter. I would make beurre blanc by the gallon at Le Côte Basque. I was buying the butter, and we were buying literally a ton of butter a year. So I thought, this is going to change. It's just a matter of when and how." Palmer's arc epitomizes the forces of the time in New York City, educated at the CIA, trained under Jean-Jacques Rochot, and referred by Mark Sarrazin to the River Café, where he forged his own muscular American style. Kinch's revelation came earlier than most. Inspired by great chefs of France, he had a crystal ball epiphany before traveling to France or working for Barry Wine. "My pride was to create a great American restaurant, to be a great American chef and not try to pretend to be French," he says. "And that was in my mind when I was 21 years old. I kept it to myself. If I talked to people about it, they were like, 'What in the world are you talking about?'" What seemed outlandish to Kinch's friends and co-workers became an accepted evolution in a matter of years. In August 1982, the Culinary Institute of America updated itself yet again in service of its constant mission to keep up with the United States' quick-shifting dining landscape. To complement the Escoffier Room, a student-run restaurant that served classic French cuisine, a new on-campus eatery was developed by 1977 CIA grad and future institute president Tim Ryan, in tandem with fellow instructor James Haywood, who had graduated the school in its New Haven days. The restaurant's name doubled as an apt title for the emerging epoch, American Bounty. 5. The Stanford Court Gang. It was the start of something bigger than we envisioned. Bradley Ogden. How one evening atop San Francisco's Knob Hill changed everything and brought rising chefs from across the country together for the first time. Bradley Ogden calls it the first gathering, the start of the American food movement. Larry Forgione describes it as a giant tribal council. Jimmy Schmidt says it went on for decades. It was a dinner billed simply as an American celebration. It was held on May 4, 1983, the day prior to James Beard's 80th birthday, at the Stanford Court Hotel, perched high atop San Francisco's Knob Hill. It was the brainchild of Michael McCarty, Julia Child, and Robert Mondavi, founding members of the American Institute of Wine and Food, AIWF. It was a multi-course, collaborative dinner that would present a sampling of what the new American chefs were up to from coast to coast. There are probably at least 2 such dinners happening in the United States tonight. At the time, it was unprecedented. Most of the chefs, though well known in their home markets, had never met before, and in some cases hadn't heard of each other. They arrived at the Stanford Court skeptical, strangers. They left, realizing they were part of a larger movement, ready to take their craft and careers to the next level.
We weren't connected at all.
I was Michael's chef, so I was a little bit his bitch, so I became the one who had to organize it, recalls Jonathan Waxman, who had been chef at Michael's for 3 years when McCarty told him of his outlandish plan to bring chefs from around the country together for one night, have each one contribute a course to be paired with American wines, at a dinner for hundreds of guests at San Francisco's Stanford Court Hotel. Waxman began lining up people, mostly those he knew personally, meaning mostly Californians, Mark Miller, Jeremiah Tower, Alice Waters. He invited his buddy, Larry Forgione, but none of New York City's five couples or others who were breaking the mold on the East Coast, such as Lydia Shire and Jasper White in Boston, or Norman Van Aken in Florida. That said, Paul Prudhomme had become famous enough that he made the cut.
There wasn't a real connection amongst all these American chefs at that point, says Waxman. Everybody had their little citadels everywhere. You had Paul Prudhomme doing his thing in New Orleans. You had people in Boston doing different stuff, in Miami. Everybody was kind of doing their thing in different places, but we weren't connected at all. We weren't aware of each other at all.
They were so unaware of each other that when Waxman compiled his initial list and somebody, Tower claims credit, McCarty says it was James Beard, suggested adding Kansas City's Bradley Ogden and Detroit's Jimmy Schmidt to represent the center of the country, Waxman had no idea who they were talking about. Ogden was a Traverse City, Michigan native who had grown up hanging around his father's rock and roll palace, the Tan's House, Dance House, and enjoying the natural riches of the Midwest, hunting and fishing for ducks, pheasant, quail, ice-cold brook trout, small and largemouth bass, perch in the winter. He and his twin brother occasionally spent weeks on his Hungarian grandmother's farm, learning what to do with those catches and kills, as well as baking pies. It was, says Ogden, typical Midwest, but English, Hungarian, a little American Indian, the wild side. He and one of his brothers started at the CIA together. The brother dropped out, but Ogden graduated in 1977 and went to work for a restaurant company to which Joe Baum's group consulted. He took the reins at the American restaurant in Kansas City, often found himself face-to-face with Baum, including trips to New York, where Baum, Barbara Kafka, and James Beard wined and dined him, showed him what was up in the Big Apple, took him to the Four Seasons. He always came back dazzled and updated his menu. Ogden incorporated local ingredients, developed a distinctly Midwestern style based on his childhood food memories, and became a local celebrity, making regular television appearances. Schmidt was doing similar work at the London Chop House in Detroit, but though he also drew on local bounty, he came to his style by way of Europe. Born in 1955 and raised in Champaign, Illinois, the last of five kids on a family farm, he'd always been surrounded by great ingredients, but not great cooking. Dinners out consisted of fried fish sandwiches or a Swedish buffet. He went to college on an engineering scholarship, but followed a quietly rebellious streak, first in New York, where he spent time with his sister in the summer, returning to the Midwest decked out in a Nehru jacket and Beatles sunglasses. That didn't go over very well, he remembers. In 1973 and 1974, he studied abroad, in Avignon and Aix-en-Provence, where he met legendary chef and teacher Madeleine Comment. His interest in cooking sprung purely out of practicality. I took cooking classes because I was a poor student and I wanted to eat. And then I took wine classes. Richard Olney and Simone Beck were also involved in Comment's program, so he met them as well. He hit it off with Comment and visited several Michelin two-star restaurants as part of the class. He followed Comment to Boston and her cooking school, Modern Gourmet. His mother thought he was nuts. When I was moving to Boston, she was like, "You're crazy!" So I'm living in Boston, and she sends me a little written note in the mail, and inside was a book of matches like you used to get at the tobacco store. And inside it says, "Learn a career, fix radios." She kept sending me books of matches to learn how to fix toasters. After graduation in 1977, he worked at Kamau's student-run restaurant for 2 years. Then his mentor introduced him to Lester Gruber,
a tough guy, we banged heads a lot, who offered him a job. The London Chop House specialized in, says Schmidt, period food that was French-influenced, like veal Oscar and Bernays sauces, and asparagus with hollandaise and clams casino, oysters Rockefeller, and all of those kind of standards, and lobster bisque and some of the other classics, Dover sole, all of which was very foreign food to me because it isn't really French food. Before long, Schmidt was promoted to chef, based on his sensibility, developed in France, and started drawing on what was available locally in dishes such as mousseline of pike. Because with the Great Lakes you had all the great fish, he says. I was playing around with mixing components together. I played around a lot with spice levels relative to using vanilla and what's considered dessert spices into entrees, like a breast of pheasant that was cured in vanilla and ginger. That type of direction. Gruber knew Beard, so Schmidt got to know him as well. He was pretty dry, but he was like a walking encyclopedia. If you'd say, hey, what's the deal about a triple lamb chop, loin chop? Where did it come from? You could get a lot of information out of him. And he was very forthcoming with it, too. I had a million questions. How many different varieties of tarragon are there? What's the difference between the French stuff and the American stuff? He was very calm, really dry, very interested in everything that was going on. Obviously, he was very interested in Larry Forgione with An American Place. He actually told me about Larry's opening. Gruber also visited France a few times a year, occasionally bringing Schmidt along. Desperate for first-rate product, Schmidt returned from those sojourns with seeds for red peppers, arugula, and herbs, then convinced local farmers' kids to grow them for him, paying them for the harvests in cash. He also introduced a bread program to the Chop House, ordering cookbooks from Kitchen Arts and Letters in New York and other specialty stores, and baking it fresh twice a day. People hadn't considered the idea of a regional cuisine as he had presented it. Prudhomme was, paradoxically, at the time, the most famous of the group present for the dinner, and unquestionably the outlier. A chef who had developed independent of many of the cultural forces that had led many of his professional contemporaries into the kitchen. Born July 13, 1940, Prudhomme was the youngest of 13 children in a poor sharecropping family who lived on their farm outside Opelousas, Louisiana. The name Paul was entered on his birth certificate by a priest who insisted he have a saint's name, but he wouldn't learn that until years later. Instead, he went by Jean Autry Prudhomme. Since Prudhomme came from a destitute family, his initial impressions of the professional cooking trade were the very opposite of many of those who wandered into the kitchen from middle-class backgrounds. It seemed positively regal to him. In 1949, at age 9, he had heard of a cousin who worked in a New Orleans hotel and earned $150 per week. It seemed like an awesome amount of money to cook, he said. I mean, to be a cook, which was fun, and to get paid that much money and be all dressed in white just seemed like a wonderful thing. When his sisters left home, he helped his mother cook, leading him, as a young adult, to his first forays into the professional kitchen. His inaugural attempt at entrepreneurship was a disaster. In 1957, at age 17, he opened a drive-in burger joint, Big Daddy-O's Patio, in Opelousas, Louisiana. In less than a year, the restaurant and Prudhomme's first marriage had gone belly up. He tried his hand at three other restaurants, and each of them went under as well. He took to selling magazines, then knocked around the West Coast, mostly in Colorado, cooking in restaurant kitchens. It was at the Elkhorn Lodge in Estes Park, where he had his version of the epiphany that so many of his peers had, when he got his hands on some small, store-bought red potatoes. They were a favorite of his, but no matter how he dolled them up, he couldn't reproduce the sensuousness of the ones his mother had cooked for him as a boy. Then it hit him. I remembered that the first thing we did was we went out to the field and we dug them up. I recognized at that point how important it is to have fresh ingredients, he said. In 1970, he returned to New Orleans. He did time at two hotels, as sous chef at Le Pavillon and then at Maison Dupuis, where he had begun experimenting with Cajun food, and in 1975, he became the first American-born executive chef of Commander's Palace, where he was initially hired as the lunch chef, but took over the entire restaurant within a week. He transitioned the menu to his evolving roster of Cajun specialties,
such as chicken and andouille gumbo.
The gumbo I did at Commander's was a roux gumbo, said Prudhomme. To my knowledge, it has never been before. It became a staple. It was chicken and andouille gumbo. It was down in dirty Cajun. It was what Mama used to do. I'd go into the country and buy the andouille from the guy I'd known since I was a